Blog Talk Radio.
Experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Danny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susie and Denny have the night off.
Okay, very good. Our first case tonight is the Dr. William Pettit and his family case, the Cheshire murder case from Cheshire, Connecticut. The second trial is underway right now in connection with the home invasion and brutal murder of a mother and two daughters who were killed in their home in Cheshire, Connecticut on July the 23rd, 2007. The family of Dr. William Pettit Jr. was attacked by two career criminals who broke into the family's home and held them hostage. Dr. Pettit survived the ordeal, just barely. His wife was forced to go to a bank and withdraw money before she was returned to the house, then assaulted, and then murdered. Dr. Pettit's two daughters were killed in a fire that was set by the intruders as they departed the home. One of the attackers was tried and found guilty and sentenced to death. The second man, who authorities are calling a mastermind behind the crime, is currently on trial. How and why did this crime happen? What can be done to prevent something like this from happening again? An absolutely amazing case. The two subjects, the one that already has gotten the death penalty conviction is Stephen Hayes, and the man on trial right now is Joshua Komarzewski. And it's an unbelievable case. I've talked about this case many times on TV and radio programs. In my opinion, from being involved as a police officer and a private detective since the late 1960s, it is, for me, the worst case that I've ever seen. It rivals the Truman Capote book In Cold Blood, where the Clutter family murders in Kansas. Richard Hickok and Perry Smith were involved in that. And, of course, the very famous Tate LaBianca murders in California by the Manson clan. Now, let me just say this. Not too long ago, I did a Joy Behar show, a couple of them, talking about the first trial when that was going on. And I had said then that, to me, it was the worst murder I have ever seen or heard of in my whole career, to which Joy said, well, you know, same thing I said before, what about the Manson, what about this? And I basically said to her, it's like picking apples from oranges, okay? I mean, they can all stand on their own, these cases here, this Cheshire murder case of the Pettit family. I want to give everybody a quick little background for about the seven or eight people across the country that have not heard about this case yet. These two guys, Hayes and Komarzewski, wanted to pick out some victims. So they were at a grocery store. She saw Mrs. Pettit and her daughter there, her younger daughter, shopping. They keyed in on her. They followed them back to their home and decided that that was the house they were going to hit. Like I said in my introduction, they broke into the house, forced Mrs. Pettit to go to the bank with one of the bad guys and withdraw money. Otherwise, the other bad guy was going to kill the family. Okay, she went, she drew out the money. Within an hour, she was dead. It's amazing to look at the video and her, and the last pictures of her at the teller's cage and realize that in about 45 minutes or so, she will be dead. Now, what these guys did, our listeners need to understand, they raped, they had sex. One of the daughters, Michaela, was 11 years old. They had sex with her. They started with oral sex. They took pictures then of her while she was tied to the bed and everything. They proceeded to take pictures, video, which they were going to send out to people they knew if they had gotten farther with this. Poured gasoline all over the house, including the bedroom where the girls were and Mrs. Pettit, and set them all on fire. Just heard yesterday on a recap from the New Haven courthouse where this is going on that when they talked about the children, they died of not only so much soot and everything in their mouth, but first, second, and third degree burns. So just imagine the horror, folks, of this case, how these girls died. First they were raped, then they had to endure pictures taken of them. Then they had to endure gasoline poured. Then they had to endure the flame going up. And I think today they said it took several minutes for them to die. So they, I want to state two things. When they, and then we'll go on to talk about some other aspects. When the first trial was going on, they did a survey outside the New Haven courthouse. And they asked, they looked for people that were totally against the death penalty. And they took a poll, and these people that were against the death penalty had said, hey, I've been against the death penalty all my life. I don't believe in it at all. It should not be, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. But yet most of them said, but these guys need to get the death penalty. I said this on a show the other day, and I stated, boy, how does that ring out? What a statement is that? Number two, they asked the people that they interviewed, give me one word as to this case. And I think it was 80-something percent of the people said evil. So, you know, Tom, it's an amazing case when you think about what these men did. And Tom, you and me have seen everything in our careers, as well as every police officer, private detectives. We've seen the murders. We've seen the people using shotguns to kill themselves and, you know, all the blood and all the body parts. But this case does not need a PR agent. This case can stand on its own for the actual viciousness, Tom. The people that have come up to me have said that's all they talk about, especially in the Northeast. They go, Vito, can you imagine that case? What do you think of that case? And it's people are mesmerized by what these individuals did, Tom. What's your thought on that?
I agree with you.
I know I gave you a big lead in. I know I gave you a big lead in, but I wanted our people to understand, please, what happened on this, Tom.
No. You've provided very detailed, factual background, and I agree with you that this is one of the most depraved, horrific crimes that in my lifetime I have ever witnessed. I'm really, you know, at a loss at sometimes to explain the depravity, why they would go to the lengths that they did. They weren't just there to rob them. They were there to torture them, and that's what they did. And, you know, I got to tell you, having watched some recent coverage, I've seen Dr. Pettit. That poor individual is internalizing his stress. He must have lost another 30 to 40 pounds. And, you know, it's just, I cannot imagine living with that kind of a loss. But now, you know, let's, you know, what I would like to do is, you know, again, analyze, you know, how did this happen? All right, well, they were targeted, and, you know, obviously I don't know what went on with the, you know, their home security system, but certainly a home security system needs to be addressed. If this can happen in an upscale community, it can happen anywhere. So I think, you know, in terms of preventing this from happening in the future, you know, families really need to be aware of their environment at all times. They can never let their guard down. Never let their guard down. So they need to harden the perimeter of their dwelling, and they need, you know, and the technology exists out there. The variety of security systems, you know, it'll fit anybody's budget. And now let's talk about the, if we can here, this woman, Mrs. Pettit, is in the bank, and she is conversing and telling the personnel at the bank that her family is being held hostage. And, I mean, I don't have an explanation as to why and how she was allowed to walk out that bank door. She should have been kept there. They should have stalled. They should have called. They did call the police. And then the police actually went by the house. They were doing their surveillance. I mean, this thing is a case study in, you know, what not to do. Do you agree?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, it's a shame, because all she's trying to do is in her mind, save her family's life. Now, again, she should have been held at the bank. They could have called the police right away, and the police would have grabbed, I believe it was Hayes that was there, and got him out of the mix, okay? And she would be safe. You know, Mr. Pettit, they beat him so severely. He was one more blow away from dying, they said. One more blow. He barely made it. He crawled on his hands and knees to a neighbor's house. And to go back, Tom, to what you said at the beginning there about home security, not only home security, I'm a Connecticut boy. This took place in upstate Connecticut, very, very safe town. But we cannot be lulled to sleep by the safe town thing around us, okay? Because when you're at a store, when you're walking out of a store, even a simple thing with your daughter at a grocery store in a safe community, you need to see who's looking at you. See if that guy's car starts up the same time as you. After you make a couple of turns, see if that person is following you. It's easy for us to say now. When somebody lives, Connecticut is a very, very rich area in many, many cities, okay? And people are lulled to sleep by the lack of crime in their towns. But and your home security, I always like the security systems. My partner does them many times for people. He sets them up where as soon as you step on the driveway or the first blade of glass, it lights up your whole property like it's middle of the day, okay, because that will keep the bad guys away. But, you know, it's an unbelievable case, and you started off by saying you're at a loss, and I've been at a loss on the shows, and the guests that I've been on with stutter and stammer because they've never seen anything like that. And these are professionals that have done hundreds of shows, and sometimes they get at a loss for words too, Tom, you know?
Well, again, you know, the lighting that you talked about, lighting is the best cheap form of crime prevention measure that any household can engage in. And I would love to see at some point a resurgence of the crime prevention measures that many local departments, you know, prior to the budget constraints, had engaged in. We don't see McGruff much anymore on television reminding residents to, before they get out of their automobile in a parking lot, look around, see, you know, what's going on, be aware of your surroundings, and likewise, when you go home, before you enter your dwelling, make sure that, you know, you have assessed the area and that there are no, you know, suspicious activities. And if you do observe any suspicious activity, immediately call 911 and report it.
Right.
What's sad about this case is that the bank personnel were on the phone and they were conversing with the telephone telephone call taker there, and saying that, well, this woman just said that someone's in her house there and she's leaving and she's getting in a car and she's going. Perhaps they need an update on the policy on when somebody reports that there's a barricaded individual at, mm-hmm. at their dwelling. Now, I know that this is not something that routinely happens, but it just highlights the the need to revisit not only your personal protection measures, but communities need to emphasize crime prevention.
Right, that's a good point. And Tom, it's going on again during the second trial, but it happened a lot during the first trial. And again, when I did Behar's show, she was trying to coax all of the guests on there to talk about the police and what they did wrong. And many guests jumped on that. I did not, because I studied it. And I found out, and as I looked into this case, Captain Vignola, who got the call, he went to the scene, he parked a distance away, he told all the incoming officers no lights and siren. Okay, they set up a perimeter far away where nobody can see from the house. Now, going back to Mrs. Pettit again at the bank, if they would have kept her there, okay, and the police went there while the other police officer grabs the guy that drives away and puts him under arrest, Mrs. Pettit could have told the police the whole layout of the land, the whole layout of who's inside the house. I got an 11-year-old. I got a 17-year-old. My husband looks like this. He has glasses. He's about 6'2". He has a blue shirt on today. And there's one bad guy there, and here's what he looks like. And right now, when I left, they're all down in the family room, and I think he was tying them up or in the bedroom. So she would have been able to lay out a whole thing, because everybody who doesn't know police work is still yelling and screaming, oh, my God, 20 minutes to a half hour went by. Why didn't they storm the house? Reason for that is, number one, the captain called on the SWAT team. The SWAT team is not standing at headquarters in their full attire waiting for a call to come. A lot of them are at home. They need to be found. They have to get dressed. They live maybe 40 minutes away in a different town. They have to assemble, go to headquarters, and get into all that type of a thing. So you can't storm a house. Main reason is, just even when a bank, when people are holding hostages, you don't storm any place. You don't storm a house because they have no information who's inside there. Who are we looking
You're
for?
Right, right.
Is
You're
Mr.
Right.
Pettit a bad guy? Are we going to shoot Mr. Pettit? Are we going to shoot this other guy? You see, people don't realize that. This guy took control of the situation. Now, in retrospect, I'm sure he thinks a lot about, geez, what else could we have done? But he didn't do anything wrong. You're told to control, contain, and communicate in a hostage situation. And that's what you're supposed to do. And that's what he tried to do. He hid the cars so much that nobody from the house could see. He was waiting on the SWAT team. He was going to start making communications with the house, getting their negotiator to talk to who's ever in the house and start to work on that whole thing. So let's not have the public continue to jump on the police department like they're going to storm through the door, and you don't know what's on the other side of the door. Right, Tom?
No, I agree with you. I'm in full agreement with your observation of the contain, control, and communicate. And, I mean, to their credit, the police caught them there. They were fleeing.
Right.
They did not understand, nor were they in a position to understand the dynamics of what was occurring. And this really unfolded very, very quickly. And you're right. I mean, it takes time for them to get the tactical team in there. Again, I would focus back on improving upon the partnership between the law enforcement and the commercial entities, namely, the bank and other businesses, so that when something like this occurs in the future, that there is a detailed procedural statement of what to do. And again, you know, they should have told, somebody should have told the bank manager, do not let her go. I mean, you know, and I imagine, you know, that anybody that was working in the bank that day, that was working in the department that day, in the telephone reception area, and the officers on duty are deeply affected by the depravity of these two career criminals. Now let's focus on them. You know, it's a sad commentary on our society that we continue to have these kind of crimes occurring. And you know, what do we do? I mean, obviously, the death penalty is the appropriate disposition here. I mean, again, after Komijewski is, after he receives due process, and if that's the sentence that is meted out, then you know, then so be it. This issue that they're, you know, the defense, and I've done criminal defense work, and I know you have as well. But you know, this issue of insanity. I don't buy it. This was as close to the devil as I think we can get.
Oh yeah, Tom, it has to be. I mean, you know, it's so amazing that how emotionally involved that not only myself but other people that have worked law enforcement for years that I've talked to and had them on shows and they don't even know what to say. They can't even describe these two guys. You rape this girl. You perform oral sex on her. You set her on fire. You pour gasoline on her. You're taking a video while she's looking at you, wondering, what's happening to me? I'm 11 years old. Where's my mom? Where's my sisters? My dad dead downstairs? I mean, what a horrible way to go out of life. And it just, you know, the shows that you turn on Fox, everything, every hour, They're highlighting it. They got guests from all over the place, all saying basically the same thing we're doing, Tom. You know, they're saying, Shepard, I don't know what to say, man. You got me on here. I don't know what to say. It's evil. It's evil.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening over here. And, you know, but see, here's one difference that our audience needs to know. The first trial, there was no arguments going back and forth. The defense team finessed herself through the whole trial, blah, 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 and the guy was given the death penalty. You got a different story now going on this time. You got aggressive defense attorneys that are going after everything. They went after the judge. They wanted him removed. They didn't win. They wanted the venue changed from that courthouse to someplace else in the state of Connecticut. They didn't win with that. They complained about the first trial because they noticed some of the reporters and different people were twittering from their rows of seats, and that bothered them. And they wanted a mistrial for that, as well as not allowing anybody to do that. And they put Dr. Pettit on the stand this time, and really, for what this poor guy has gone through, raked him over the coals for 20 to 25 minutes. So will it work? No. No, because, you know, I think this is interesting because it was one of the first times that before even the first trial started, Tom, when the defense attorneys came to court, the prosecutor said to them, no talking to us. There's nothing on the table here. We're not offering anything. Don't even bother to ask us. This is death penalty all the way, more than what we've ever seen in our life. Please don't talk to us. And basically threw them out of the office. You know, so that's where we stand right now, Tom.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult case. I don't envy the jurors sitting there having to review the testimonial evidence from Dr. Pettit, reviewing the physical evidence in the form of photographs, you know, autopsy reports.
People have gone home sick, Tom.
People have gone off
sick. A lady bought off the first trial, I believe. She got off from the jury because she couldn't sleep and was on doctor's care. I mean, because you, as a juror, you have to sit there, and these things are tossed around to you. The defense is looking at you. You have to eyeball these things. Okay, it's a tough thing to tell people to do, but you have to. And they looked at the girls in bed, burnt alive, and they had to look at everything else going on in this case. So it's very tough.
Now, you know, let's get into the sociology of these two guys. I mean, how does somebody carry out this kind of depravity?
Well, you got Komar Zjeski blaming it all on Stephen Hayes, where Hayes, because he was saying Hayes was the older guy, he's in his 40s, Komar Zjeski, I think, is early 20s, and he's trying to blame Stephen Hayes for orchestrating this thing. Whereas Hayes, who didn't put up any fight in the first trial, he wasn't trying to save himself or anything, said, I was like under the spell of Komar Zjeski. Everything he said, he even said, hey, he said to Hayes, okay, go ahead. I just raped and did this to the 11-year-old. You go take the mom now. Go on. And he did. He went in the room and he took care of her that way, sexually and killing her. So, you know, the first guy, Hayes, at least to his benefit, did not, he said that it was Komar Zjeski, but he didn't do it to get any pressure off himself. Now, the second trial is a totally different story. They're yelling and screaming that my poor client, sure, he did this, he did that, but he really wasn't the bad guy. Imagine that. How can you represent somebody like that? He's really not the bad guy. I'm sorry to hit everybody with polls, but the polls across the country, most hated woman in America, easy. Casey Anthony was voted. Most hated men, tie these two guys. So, you know, it is what it is, Tom.
Yeah, and Hayes, I think, you know, from what I recall, you know, he was pretty much throwing in the towel, saying, you know, something, I really messed up big time here.
Yeah, yeah. You got both of them saying, I can't believe we did this. I can't believe it got out of hand. It wasn't supposed to happen like this. Well, you know, that's too bad. You know, it's not gonna do them any good. Before we run out of time, let's talk a second, Tom. I want to get your opinions, too, on Dr. Pettit. I did a show where a psychologist was on and said, imagine what this guy is going through. The nights waking up 3 in the morning. Now, he's gone from a house full of people to losing his wife and two daughters, lost everybody. I even said today to somebody, gee, at least if maybe one of the kids was still alive for him, there'll be him and a daughter at least. You know what I mean? But he has nobody. He's an empty house, the whole bit. He lays there at night and thinks about the testimony in the day that says your poor daughter had loaded with soot all through her mouth, gagging, set on fire, couldn't even scream because she's choking. I mean, imagine as a parent to just think about that, Tom. What's your impressions on that? What are we dealing with here, man? It's incredible. You there, Tom? Hello? I don't know if they lost me or if they lost Tom. One of our bloggers, let me know if you hear me. Hello?
Hey, Vito. Yeah, I got knocked off.
Oh, okay.
I'm back.
Okay, I was just saying, I don't know what you call, I was just saying, poor Mr. Pettit. The psychologist had said what he has to put up with, the waking up 3 in the morning, thinking about how his kids and his wife were killed, the screams they had, being raped, murdered, set on fire, the soot in their mouth. I just wanted your comments on it, you know.
Well, you know, that's classic survivor's guilt. Why am I alive?
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched that man, and I cannot imagine being in his position. I wouldn't be able to cope. I don't know that I'd even be able to get out of bed.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
It's just so overwhelming that these kinds of people are on our landscape.
Yeah.
And again, to go back to and to sum up here, you know, as a former cop, and I think you would agree as a former cop yourself, that crime prevention, at the local level, with the citizen as well as the local municipal agency, is something that needs to be revisited, and every strategic opportunity to educate the public, in my humble opinion as a former police chief, needs to be addressed.
And the public needs to realize in a situation like that, when you're dealing with two criminals that do not have masks on, okay, that they have criminal histories, they're readily identifiable by any people that are left alive, okay, to think that you can go in the bank, and this is no reflection on Mrs. Pettit. She did what she felt she had to do. But if you think you could go back to the house and the guys are going to say, okay, thank you, bye-bye, and not be killed because you eyeballed both of them, is a big mistake. So that's all I wanted to end with on that part.
All right, well, let's shift gears and talk about some other depravity that's on the landscape. Police authorities in Suffolk County, New York, are still investigating the recent discovery of multiple human remains along an oceanfront stretch on Long Island. Police have linked a human skull and other skeletal remains found last March to other body parts that were recovered back in 2000. In press conferences, police appear baffled about the case. They have not identified all of the remains. They are scouring through missing persons reports, seeking to match the remains with unresolved local missing persons cases. Police have not identified a suspect, nor have they mentioned a person of interest. Question, is this the work of one pathological killer? Or is the beachfront along Ocean Parkway known as a convenient dumping ground used by an assortment of criminals, including mobsters and psychopaths? I don't know. What do you think?
Learning a lot about this case, too, and talking to somebody that has frequented that area dozens and dozens of times, that have gone there on trips, knows exactly the dumping ground, let's call it, the area over there. He says it's an area that's a little bit away, not far away, but right on the oceanfront. Like many eastern shore towns are, but it's a very good hiding place because it's pretty huge, and you could really bring somebody in there, dump them. Now, the show I did on it, I talked a lot about, in doing research, I talked a lot about the only good thing about this case, and it's hard to find a good thing when they start finding all these bodies, is that some of the bodies they have found may go back several years. Okay, which could be a mob hit, somebody buried there. It could be a missing person that a family's been looking for maybe 7 years. Now all of a sudden they can kind of put that to rest by saying, oh, my God, they found our daughter. We knew she was probably dead, but at least they found her remains now. So at least on that part, Tom, I think it's something that is helpful. The guy is tedious. The show I did, the people were talking about all the former serial killers before, and, you know, little mistakes, how they were found. If you think about the Son of Sam, he was found by a parking ticket that was on his vehicle. That's how he was finally determined. I mean, he was getting away, and he was more brazen than this guy, who's ever guy or guys that are doing this. I mean, Son of Sam would basically, you know, walk down the street, look for two lovers in a car back in 77, and go and shoot them. So, you know, that you're taking a big chance not to get caught, all the different murders he did. This is a little bit more easier in the sense of maybe in the middle of the night, pretty deserted area, very quickly you get out, you take the body, you're buried or whatever you're going to do, and you hop back in your car as long as nobody doesn't see you. So it's an interesting case, Tom. So far there hasn't been a panic, I can tell you, on the East Coast yet. There hasn't been a big stir like the Son of Sam thing happened, but it's starting to kick into gear now, Tom.
Yeah, well, you know, what I find interesting is that the remains of four victims were found in December 2010, and then six more sets of remains were found in March and April of 2011, and two sets of those remains predate, so they go back. And so, you know, it sounds like this is the work of more than one individual. And again, what does that say about psychological, you know, deviants that are on the landscape here with us?
Yeah, yeah. And also they found also the body of a very young child, too. They have located that.
Yeah, that was related to the mother of the child was found elsewhere.
Right. Right. So, you know, again, like you said before, a lot of spots in New York, especially a lot of the working organized crime for many, many years that I did, a lot of the dumping spots near LaGuardia Airport, a lot of areas where the organized crime for many, many decades would dump bodies off there. And just recently now, over the last several years, have bodies been found. And it's proven to be by undercover cops and organized crime people that told the truth after they were caught about using these areas. And they'll say, hey, there was four bodies dumped there, but my bosses did, and this and that. They need a big break on this case, though, Tom. They need a big break. Do you think, Tom, that they have undercover people working a midnight shift, hiding someplace? Do you think, what would you do as chief of police? Would you assign a couple people, guy or a girl, just hidden someplace, waiting to spot that? See, you know, that suspicious car where, if nothing else, you grab a plate number?
Well, I think here's my take on this. With all of the publicity and the notoriety, you know, that's been associated with the recovery of the remains, in late 2010 and in the spring of 2011, I don't know that I would deploy personnel looking for, you know, somebody that might be coming by. What I would be doing would be, again, focusing on the crime scene investigation aspect of it, looking for similarities between the items found, you know, that were, you know, might have bound the victims. I know that there were burlap bags. You know, that would immediately suggest to me, and I mentioned this on the Nancy Grace show, you know, burlap bag, again, as a former, in addition to being a former police chief in an oceanfront community, I was also the harbor master and the shellfish warden. And, you know,
right,
as soon as I heard, you know, burlap bags, there was oceanfront, I said, that's got to be either a clammer, somebody who digs for clams,
mm-hmm,
or somebody who does fishing.
Good point.
That's a convenient, opportunity to, you know, get rid of a body, put it in a burlap bag, and then lug it, and then dump it. And,
right,
and again, there are four of these women were identified as women working in the arena of prostitution. And so, okay, you know, let's focus some resources on, again, you know, the CSI aspect of it. Is there any trace evidence left by the perpetrator at each of these scenes that can be connected, you know, and then you know, run it through the CODIS system and see if there's something there. So I would be, you know, all in favor of, you know, again, going back. And again, you know, they call this particular fellow, because some of these girls had been advertising on Craigslist. They're referring to him as the Craigslist Ripper. You know, go back and have, technicians, you know, try to identify the IP addresses associated with the correspondence that connected these, you know, dead victims with their killer. So
right,
that's where I would go. But again, that's just my, you know, perspective on it.
Right. Do you think this is a solvable case, either through the DNA or, you know, it happens a lot of times, you know yourself, on cases of this nature, Tom. You get that rookie cop that's on patrol, and just by accident, so to speak, he spots a car. Maybe somebody's going to the bathroom behind a bush or something like that, and he's smart enough coming out of the police academy to, if nothing else, again, take that plate number and check into the person. So, I mean, a lot of times you get those, like I said, the other case was solved by a parking ticket. You know, it wasn't solved by somebody apprehended. It was solved by a parking ticket, and they logged that. Okay, let's check this guy. He was in this area. He got a ticket the night somebody was killed.
All right, I agree with you, all right? That's when you and I were on the beat, okay?
Right.
Now, a lot of the communication occurs on the Internet. So much like, you know, when you and I were walking the beat with a portable radio dangling from our hip, and going and hitting the box and watching the light in the square when it went off. It would be like, hey, you got to pick up the hook and call. There's a, you know, there's something going on.
Yep.
Here, I think it again. You know, the young officers that are proficient with the technology, I think they need to scour the internet records, because these killers and these pedophile predators are out there on the internet, and so that's where, you know, I mean, if I were back in law enforcement, I would be encouraging budgetary resources to enhance our ability to, you know, to go on the internet and to police there. So, you know, you and I are talking about the street, looking at the, the cars that were in violation of the parking meters. I would say to you that today, the highway that we want to focus on is the internet highway.
Oh, of course, right. You're
and so
right.
You know, I think that's where they're going to come up with a hit, because obviously the communication was there. These women were advertising, and so what they have to do is methodically go backwards and go through all of that, you know, that interactive dialogue that had occurred and come up with. And again, you know, I'm not a criminal profiler, but I would say to you that, you know, somebody with a burlap bag, you know, that's oceanfront, that's somebody that, you know, is obviously involved with, the fishing industry, the clamming industry, you know, somebody that's, you know, going after these women that are applying their skills as prostitutes, you know, and try to identify those areas and work backwards. That's just my particular perspective on it.
That's a good point. Now, are you using, on one of your lines, are you using Denny's name, or is Denny actually one of our
No,
blogs?
No, that's me. I'm using, to get in, using
okay.
Denny's.
I was just going to, now, if any of our people listening have any comments on either one of the cases we've talked about, please, type them in. Let us see them. See if we can answer anything for you. Any questions about these cases? These are two huge cases we're talking about tonight. You know, a lot of times, especially like next week, we'll be talking about unsolved cases. Sometimes they go back a little bit. These are two very current things going on right now, very what they call high-profile cases across the country. One is in New York, one is in Connecticut. But if anybody has any questions at any time, just please put it in. We will check and try to answer it to the best of our ability. So it's an interesting case. It's an interesting case. I had done it a couple months ago, and then, like you know, on these kind of cases, a lot of times it goes quiet for many months, you know. And see, the difference with the Son of Sam, that was pretty much fairly steady. And that was the summer of 77, New York City. Everything was in an uproar. And, front page in all the newspapers, he strikes again, all that kind of stuff. And the letters that he, the notes that he would send to law enforcement and or the paper. And but this is a little different now. This is a shoreline community, shorefront community. It's not going on every week. Kind of goes in streaks a little bit. But we'll see how this all plays out, Tom, you know. Very bad.
Yeah. Now, let me just say, reiterate here that the four bodies discovered in December 2010, the four women had been advertising their services on Craigslist. They all had been strangled and their bodies wrapped in burlap sacks. So I think, we can say that, one individual is responsible for those women. And, let me just, mention their names here. The first woman discovered was Maureen Brainerd Barnes. She was 25 of Norwich, Connecticut. And she had advertised her services as a prostitute online. And she was last seen on July 9th, 2007. And her body was found in December 2010. The second victim was Melissa Bartholomew. She was 24, and she was from Erie County, New York. She went missing on July 10th in 2009, and she had been living in the Bronx and working as an escort through Craigslist. The third woman was Megan Waterman. She was 22 years of age, and she was from Scarborough, Maine. She went missing on June 6th of 2010 after placing advertisements on Craigslist as an escort. And the fourth woman, Amber Lynn Costello, 27, of North Babylon, New York, a town 10 miles north of Gilgo Beach, she was a prostitute and a heroin user, and she went missing on September 2nd, 2010. And, you know, just given the, you know, the geographical and the temporal, the you know, the time relationship here, this is, you know, these crimes were perpetrated by somebody who was obviously trolling in the area and trolling on the Internet.
Right. And
so
and not
I,
only,
I think that,
so go ahead, Tom, go ahead.
No, I think that, you know, that in terms of, you know, triangulating here, again, you know, just said, you know, it would be some young cop, but it will be some young cop that is astute with, you know, the Internet and coming up with a, you know, a diagram and a flowchart that will show mm-hmm. that this individual was in the area, you know, place him, you know, working in the area, you know, and was picking women up and then dumping them there. And so that's for those four.
That's a good point, because in our day, we didn't have that avenue. It was just foot power all the time. You know, these guys, a guy could be sitting home on his day off and just putting together some pieces on the Internet, just trying to figure out something, trying to get that big break, or at least something to turn into one of the supervisors at headquarters to help them in the case. Another thing, though, for our listeners to understand, a lot of times, Tom said it before, these type of serial killers deal with prostitutes. When you're dealing with prostitutes, they've had a lot of them killed in Atlantic City also, too, over the last couple of years. What happens is a lot of the prostitutes don't have family, at least to the sense of they're not in contact with their family. So they could be murdered, and literally several months can go by without anybody looking for them. It's a sad commentary, but that can happen, and it does happen, because they're out on their own, and, you know, the most anything can happen is a couple of the other girls say, hey, where's Mary? I haven't seen Mary around here in a while. But, you know, they're not going to call the police about it because they have no suspicions about it. And Mary may not have talked to her mom or her sister or whoever in literally months. So a lot of times it takes a long time to find out that Mary is gone and or dead.
You know, you raise a good point there about the Atlantic City murders. Again, I think were there four or six of them that were discovered there. And a buddy of mine, he's a criminal profiler out of New Jersey, John Kelly, who's worked with me on half a dozen local cases here in New England. He's actually somebody that we could call and have on as a guest in the in the future to talk about the similarities between, you know, this case, you know, the oceanfront, the Ocean Park Parkway case, and what went on in Atlantic City. Now, I know that they had done a lot of a lot of DNA work there in Atlantic City, but nothing has panned out thus far. But it goes to the point that there are a number of, you know, pathological killers living amongst us. And they prey on, unfortunately, very vulnerable victims, and you know, prostitutes who have heroin addictions and other illegal drug addictions, and you know, they succumb to you know, these kinds of terrible predicaments, and it's just a sad commentary on our society.
Yeah, and not only that, Tom, these guys that are maniacs out there, sexual maniacs, and then they wind up killing their victims, what easier thing than a prostitute? Because think about it. You'll read about sometimes a guy pulling over on the side of the road in some bushes and hiding, and when some lady comes by who's running or something like that, he'll grab her and drag her into the woods, okay? A lot more difficult than pulling down a road that you know, like a Hunts Point in New York or some other kind of road that you know is frequented by prostitutes, because what do you got there? You got the woman coming over to your car, getting into your car, and driving away with you. So, I mean, for somebody that's going to commit a murder, why not the 8 or 10 prostitutes that they wind up killing? The person comes right in their vehicle to them, and it's terrible. I mean, the parents that have to worry about their daughters, that they know they're on the street someplace in a different town or doing whatever they're doing. I mean, just think about it. A woman, it's kind of like when our government talks about the terrorist. You know how we catch them so many times before they do something? But the experts say, sure, we can catch them 150 times in a row, but the 151st, we don't catch them. And I mean, so same thing with a woman getting into a stranger's vehicle several times a night for several weeks, and it goes fine. You know, she gets her money and she moves on with her career, so to speak. But then you get that one time where the guy grabs you, puts you out of commission a little bit, takes you to wherever he's going to take you, and kills you. So it only takes that one time, that one nut out of 400 or 500 that you see over the course of your career as a prostitute. It's nothing easier than driving down the road and having the woman just almost beg to get into your car with you, you know?
Yeah, because she needs to turn that trick in order to pay some bills.
Yeah, that's it.
There's a lot of stress there, and you know, that unfortunately is an ingredient that leads to their demise.
I hope they catch this person or persons, Tom. We're at the end of the summer. Beaches are basically closed, okay? So now you got pretty much fairly deserted area over there where this is taking place. See, a lot of times, like the guy who I talk to that has frequented that place and knows it like the back of his hand when he goes there with his wife, you know, he even says the summertime's the hopping time. You know, everything's going on. People are there at night walking the boardwalk and the whole bit. But now as we get to the colder weather, it makes it even easier for this guy to operate, to bring somebody, you know, because a prostitute, they also knows that's a pretty deserted area. And, you know, maybe a little bit nervous about going there knowing about these murders, but still wants to make her $50, $100, and she's going to take a chance in going, you know, very bad.
I agree that, you know, that they have to keep personnel there just to make sure that nobody else is deposited there. But I think that, you know, after the initial law enforcement response on the beach with dogs, with the all-terrain vehicles, recovery of the remains, it's now in the it's both in the laboratory, you know, performing crime scene investigation and analysis. It's that as well as identifying the online connections. So, I mean, I see a lot of work there, and I can imagine just as you could, you know, when you're a young, aggressive officer or detective.
Yep.
Once you get your teeth into something, you know, you continue on, and, you know, somebody's going to break the case because they're going to be persistent, and they're not going to give up, and it's going to gnaw at them because when, you know when, especially when you get to go to a scene and you see the remains and you inhale the terminal circumstances, you inhale it, you see it, and it is there. And actually, days later, you even, you know, you get that sense of, you know, the air. It's like there again, that you're at the scene of the crime. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very, very good point. And, you got to hope this is the type of cases that, you know, the next time you read the paper, you want to see the guy is caught. Because, you know, even if it's every 3 months he strikes, and you know, these people may be evil, but in some capacities, they are smart, too. They know a little bit about, you know, who was that guy out in the Midwest with the glasses, I guess in the Midwest? Remember, he worked as a...
BTK.
Yeah, right. Now, there's a guy who's very
Dennis
evil.
Dennis Rader.
Right, Dennis Rader, but also smart. Okay, smart in the sense of how to do his trade and to do it good for, what, 20 years? How long did it take him? You know, then he got too cocky and too many things back and forth with the police and everything of that nature. You know,
and he was perfect. You know, he could grab, the technical component. He had used a printer at at his church, and that's how he got discovered. And again, I firmly believe that this case out on Long Island is solvable and will be solved through a combination of crime scene investigation and internet investigation, and that they will intersect and that they will begin to focus on somebody that may have been a transient that was in the area. We had here in Massachusetts back in the late 80s, we had it was called the Highway Killer, and some dozen women in the course of a little over a year, their bodies were recovered down in New Bedford. I've always believed that it was a fisherman that was in the area who then may have gone back over to Europe.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yep,
may have gone over to Portugal or to Spain, because I follow that case. There were similar murders both in Portugal and in Spain.
Right. Okay.
And these fishermen. Go ahead.
I often think having a vacation home out in Henderson, Nevada, being fairly close to the desert. I mean, we could only imagine how many, if not thousands, hundreds and hundreds of bodies in a desert that goes on for hundreds and hundreds of miles out there that organized crime or whoever have buried, because there's literally no way. How can you do it unless you have the detectors that actually heat sensing things and everything that have to cover all that territory of hundreds of miles of just desert, you know? So it's amazing nowadays, the bodies that turn up all over the place. Even with this case we're talking about, you're at least salving and putting to rest some of the unsolved the murders or missing person things of the last 7 to 10 years, Tom, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw some statistics suggesting that there are nearly 50,000 unidentified remains across the country in morgues.
Wow.
And
wow.
Now, are they murder victims? Are they missing persons who succumbed to, that they were out in the desert? They might have been afflicted with a variety of mental ailments, and they're out there. But this is a longstanding problem here in our society, one that needs to be addressed. And I hope that at some point, the budgetary matters can adequately focus on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, just to sum up, these police in Suffolk County there along the oceanfront stretch, you want that one little piece of DNA that you find. Obviously, as our listeners know too, much more difficult in the middle of swamp and grass and everything else than looking for DNA in a home. Murder or something like that, because you want to find that one little strand of hair. When people commit a murder in a house, they're usually very bent up and they're sweating, so those beads of sweat that may fall at the scene, all types of things like that. Now, obviously, in these kind of situations, in these junky areas like that, very tough, but they have to scour it. They have to just say, okay, we found something here. Let's see, put it through the database, see who it comes back to if we can, and that's it, you know?
I'd want to know where those burlap bags came from.
Mm.
What kind of knots were tied on the burlap
yep.
bags? What kind of binding instruments were used to secure the remains? What kind, are there any fingerprints, any DNA? And again, I think it's a DNA case. That's my position on that.
Good show, good point, and good show tonight. We got to wrap it up here, and go ahead, Tom. You're on first there. Oh, no, I'm
upstairs.
Sorry about that. Thanks to the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 3rd. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume of your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanchak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you, good night, and God bless everybody. Bye-bye.
Good night, Vito.
Good night.